Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's May 2020, and you're listening to episode 177, which is a conversation about veganism. Is it biblical? On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Paul Copan, who is professor and Pledger Family Chair of Philosophy and Ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University in West Palm Beach, Florida. In 2017, he was a visiting scholar at Oxford University. He is also the author and editor of more than 35 books, both at the scholarly and popular level. Paul has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal, and it's called VeggieTales Gone Rogue, PETA, Veganism, and the Christian Faith. And you can read it for free online at our website, equip.org. Paul, it's good to have you on.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you, Melanie.
Well, you recently, last fall, co-edited a book that has a really intriguing title, and that's why we're having you on the Postmodern Realities podcast. And that is, this book is called What Would Jesus Really Eat? The Biblical Case for Eating Meat. And I find that to be very provocative and interesting. And I want to find out what led up to this book idea, because I think right now there's such a popularity going on in our culture, especially with the younger generation, about veganism. I mean, not just for ethical reasons, but for various health reasons. And so I just find your book title and the idea of this project very fascinating.
Yeah, it was something that came out of the blue for me. I never thought I'd be writing about something like this, but turns out that someone who is a colleague of mine here at Palm Beach Atlantic University enlisted me in a conference to participate in talking about a biblical understanding of eating meat. And it led to just some of the materials that came out in this book later on. It just was a snowballing effect that was just basically helping people who are coming from the farming, agriculture industries to really hear a case for the legitimacy of eating meat. Many of these people being from a Christian background, but often getting pummeled and bombarded by these activists who are saying it's not just simply a matter of your own personal preferences that you eat meat and sell meat and so forth, but it is wrong and you ought to stop doing that. What you're doing is cruel, etc. And so they're just here. They've been doing this, many of them, for generations, and now they're hearing these arguments that they just never heard in the past, and they're wondering, well, what sorts of defenses do we have? Even people who are saying, you know, you are Christians, you ought to have a compassionate ethic. You should be raising these animals. You shouldn't be raising them for slaughter, etc. And also consumers who are eating hamburgers and steaks and so forth, they are somehow in error, and, you know, moral error, grave moral error, even for consuming meat. And so it was really came out of this sense of questioning, how do we address, how do we come back to those sorts of arguments that are being thrown at us that we just aren't really prepared for, given some of the maybe kind of Sunday school lessons that we've heard, and really not getting a whole lot on the legitimacy of eating meat from a biblical point of view.
Well, that's very interesting. So can you give us a brief overview about the book in general? What kind of things did you cover in the book?
Well, the book is broken up into several sections, and the first part is on why words matter. And a couple of chapters are devoted to the rhetoric of the food industry, you know, things like organic or natural, and so forth. And then there's other stuff that elicits negative responses, like factory farming, industrial factory farming, et cetera. And so trying to work through some of those words, some of those evocative terms. So that's the first part that the book goes through. And then the second part is on why the issue matters. And the discussion there is on some of the challenges that have come to people of late in the farming, in the meat industry, where they're being pushed hard to adopt a new mindset, or to be, they're being challenged by a new mindset. And so that tries to put into place why the issue matters. Should personal preferences be turned into biblical commands, mandates from God, that certain things that have been part of a farming family's history, some simply be now ended? Or is there more to the discussion than that? So it gets into more of those details. And then the next section is on why people matter. And there are a couple of chapters, one on human exceptionalism, and also on another one on why it's not morally wrong to eat meat. And then the fourth portion deals with the Old and New Testament cases for eating meat, and why this is permissible, and why some of the pressures that even some well-meaning Christians are putting on others are misguided. And then finally, the last part of it is on why this matters for you. And it's written by two brothers who are hog farmers, and their family has been doing this for generations. And so they're arguing as Christians for the legitimacy of raising hogs for the well-being of others, something that is a tasty, within moderation, a healthy part of a diet that humans can enjoy, and that this should be seen as a gift from God, and that the pig farmer is not going against the mandates of Jesus Christ in raising hogs for the benefit of the consumption of other, the hog consumption on people's plates. So again, that's a bit of the breakdown of the book.
So as I mentioned, as I introduced you, that you have an article based on some of the material you wrote for the book that is an online exclusive with the Christian Research Journal, and everyone can read it, as I mentioned, for free at our website, equip.org. But why is its main title, why did you choose VeggieTales Gone Rogue? I think people think of VeggieTales as the children's animated reconception of Bible stories.
Right. Well, I thought that Veggie Tales would be certainly evocative. Our kids grew up with some of those Veggie Tales stories, and what I'm trying to do in this bit of writing that I've done for the Christian Research Journal, and also summarizes some of the things that I have to say in my chapters in the book, is that there are those both from the extreme groups like PETA and so forth, but others who are Christians who say that it is more compassionate to eat from a plant-based diet rather than to eat any sort of animal, that this is somehow anti-Jesus, it's anti-compassion. And what I argue in this is that there is a kind of an underlying pagan belief. It's not rooted in the doctrine of creation, in which God gives these good gifts to human beings to enjoy, but it's rather rooted in a kind of a pagan idea that there is no fundamental difference between human beings and animals. Genesis 1 talks about how human beings are made in the image of God, that there is a distinctiveness to humanity, that we are able to relate to God, and so forth. But animals have a different status than human beings. But within certain pagan views, and ones especially that endorse reincarnation, that you can be in one form, maybe as an animal in one life, and then in the next life you graduate to being perhaps a human being, or the other way around. And the idea that there is no fundamental difference between humanity and animal life, that the soul simply moves from one to another, is not a Christian belief at all. It's a pagan belief. It's rooted in faulty thinking, but yet a lot of Christians have bought into this idea that human beings and animals, that they're a lot closer than you may think, and so therefore we ought to treat animals as not object to be consumed or herded even, or treated as pets even, for some people will say, but rather as friends, as virtual equals in the creation order. And so that's why I'm talking about VeggieTales, false tales that people are telling about human beings, and fundamentally eliminating their distinctiveness. A lot of times when people try to elevate animals to a greater status than what is called for, a lot of times this ends up reducing human beings in their own distinctiveness, that they somehow, things somehow become equalized. So I'm trying to respond to some of those VeggieTales that people are telling. And even some of these Christians who are, people who are purported Christians who are writing, you know, against meat eating, are ones who are saying that, you know, they're even pointing out that Jesus got it wrong when he allowed the pigs to go over the cliff, doing their swine dive, that Jesus was being cruel, or the Apostle Paul was somehow misguided in some of the things that he said about eating meat, or that they take one verse of the Apostle Paul's about being compassionate and they apply it to the realm of eating meat, when just in the same book, like the book of Colossians, Paul is saying, let no one judge what you are eating. Yeah, those who say, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, and so forth. So I'm trying to address a lot of these faulty VeggieTales that are misleading many people.
Before I ask you more particularly about veganism, I was just wondering, what about the people or the Christians who would say that they wouldn't hold to any of those pagan ideals, or they would not equate humans to animals, which I know that some people do, but the reason why that they're vegan or vegetarian is because there's a compassion issue regarding the treatment of animals in terms of slaughterhouses, or if you've seen any of those documentaries, which some of them are kind of disturbing, you know, where you see, instead of having a humane way to euthanize, let's say, little baby chicks, what I saw was a big, and by the way, I totally eat meat and everything like that, but I saw this big, huge, you know, drum at the fastest way for them to do this, that they need to, is to just like put the chickens in there alive and just kill them through a blade, which seems inhumane. So how do you address those issues where people are like, well, I'm kind of concerned about how animals are treated, not because I think they're equal to humans, but I just don't think it's good to, you know, have cows standing in their own filth or something like that.
Right. People will view these sorts of things somewhat differently. And you know, there are different, when we talk about humane, when we talk about suffering, there is a certain presumption about the what animals are actually able to understand or perceive. I think that there is a fundamental difference between what human beings recognize when they are facing death and what animals do. And we'll come to some of these themes later on in terms of the food chain and so forth. But I would, that God put into place. But I would say here that sometimes we superimpose our own thinking about death, our own feelings, our own inner awareness and so forth about the purpose of life and the ending of life and so forth. And we superimpose that on animals as well, and assume that what looks like animal suffering may actually not be as profound an issue as we think. But more to the point, we're not saying that there shouldn't be better conditions and so forth, but there may be some subjective dimensions involved in here too. For example, when you have a lot of chicks or chickens together, they're all cooped up. Some people say, no, they should be free ranging. Well, that is a judgment call on what is going to be perhaps the best use of space, the best use of, best way to house chickens and indeed keep them from harming each other. There is something to that notion of pecking order, that animals in cages are better restrained and are prevented from harming than if they're running loose and so forth. And also thinking about how can you maximize space to bring the most food to the greatest number of people who want to enjoy, say, chicken. So there are those judgment calls as well. In fact, my co-editor and I, we thought about doing a part two to this as well that goes into more of those sorts of details. We stuck more with the philosophical dimensions and the biblical and ethical dimensions of this when it comes to eating meat per se. And we haven't looked at some of these other issues that are important, but they're not as, they're you know, off the beaten path in terms of what we're trying to do in terms of the case for eating meat. So that's a discussion to be had, but we just don't cover it in the book. But that's perhaps for part two.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Paul Copan, who has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. His article is called VeggieTales Gone Rogue, PETA, Veganism, and the Christian Faith. You can read his article for free online at our website, equip.org, where you can also subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. One way you can help become a partner with us and help keep this content free is to give us a donation for Paul's book from which this essay is based. And he has written a new book. He has co-written a new book called What Would Jesus Really Eat? The Biblical Case for Eating Meat. And you can find out how to partner with us at our website, equip.org. If you go to the magazine section, the drop-down menu, you'll see Postmodern Realities. If you click the landing page for this episode, you will find a link where you can partner with us and receive this gift of this book as our thank you. The other way you can partner with us is to provide us a tip. If a subscription is not in your budget right now, you can easily do that at that same landing page. Something small like $3 or $5 really helps us to keep this content free. And the best way you can help us, which is no monetary cost to you, is to provide a review for our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or particularly at Apple Podcasts. If you search for Postmodern Realities, you can see that you can do two types of reviews, a starred review or a written review. We'd really appreciate a written review. I know some of you have been thinking, yeah, I need to get around to doing it, but you haven't really done that yet. Would you please take a minute? It's just a minute, and just write us a written review. That way, more people can find our content. And thank you for your partnership and your support of helping keep this podcast free.
Well, the subtitle of your article also, you mentioned not only PETA, which is the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, but also veganism. And so is there any difference between vegetarianism and veganism that is in addition to what you can or cannot eat? So in other words, you know, vegans don't eat any kind of animal product, like, you know, so vegetarians can't eat cheese, but vegans can't because it's part of milk or, you know, dairy or eggs from chickens and those kinds of things.
Right. I mean, you're basically hitting on the difference. I mean, the vegetarianism gives a little wiggle room when it comes to, say, cheese or eggs or whatever, or fish, as opposed to veganism, which stays off of all of those animal products and is essentially a plant-based diet without any sort of variation. So the veganism is much is a stricter way of looking at it. Although in the book, we use the term prescriptive vegetarianism as referring to the kind of a mandated or the ethical normativity of a plant-based diet. So we do keep that in mind as you look at the book, that it's there's that term prescriptive Christian vegetarianism. It really just means that of veganism, but that's a term that has been used, so we're just adopting it.
So what should Christians be particularly aware of and concerned about with regard to various issues that you mention in your article? And then also, what about Christians who are vegan just for health reasons? I mean, like they've got massive food allergies and they can't eat dairy or eggs, or they can't. I mean, I have a friend who has so many food allergies, she can't eat a lot of meat and protein. So she's down to, I don't think she can even eat beans. So she's down to very few things that she can eat. And if it's prescribed for medical reasons, is that okay versus buying into some kind of philosophical view about the nature of eating meat?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, this isn't a diet handbook and spelling out all of the variations on what is good. I mean, I have a sister who's had Lyme disease, and it was important for her to have the amino acids that come from meat rather than just having a strict vegan diet. She had been much more inclined that way, but was told by medical personnel that she should have more meat in her diet in order to help her with her Lyme disease. And it can go the other way around. Some people may need to stay away from meat because of various health concerns. The noted psychologist, professor of psychology from the University of Toronto, Jordan Peterson, he and his family, basically because of genetically based reasons, went to a basically carnivore diet, I guess, because of the health problems that they had had when they were eating I think maybe a more normal diet, which included vegetables and so forth. But they went to strict to meat eating, carnivorosity on steroids because of the health problems. I think really very ill health because they, you know, their bodies just needed more meat. So you take these sorts of things on a case by case basis. So it's not, like I said, some sort of a dietary handbook that covers all things. There are judgment calls to be made, maybe foods to be avoided, certain food allergies that you need to take into account, but basically arguing for the legitimacy of eating meat. And there are even some health benefits that could go along with that when eaten in moderation.
So is there anything else besides that Christians should be aware of in terms of what you cover in your book? Because like you say, it's not really about, you know, how to select a particular diet.
Yeah. Well, I guess the upshot here is that there is a growing chorus of voices that is speaking out against any sort of meat eating. As again, for the Christian community, there are groups within various denominations rising up and advocating for a more compassionate diet, which means getting off of meat and just having a plant-based diet, and sometimes bringing into the discussion verses that are taken out of context, theological themes that are fundamentally distorted, and trying to create a dietary ethic that is fundamentally at odds with the scriptures. So it's really trying to address many of these sorts of concerns, kind of a false compassion, a more spiritual than Jesus sort of an approach to eating, that when you look at the broader teachings of scripture, you realize, no, this is cherry picking of verses rather than actually looking at fundamental themes that reach across the testaments and that are repeated, that fly in the face of this sort of a new ethic that we're seeing on the rise that Christians are being pressured into.
You talk about the image of God and human exceptionalism in your book. Can you expand on what you mean by that?
Sure. And I alluded to this a little bit earlier, but when we talk about the image of God, that God has made human beings with certain capacities to, for example, relate to God, the capacity of spirituality, the capacity for living a moral life, the capacity of moral agency and free will, the capacity to think rationally, to be self-aware of one's own inner being, of one's, you know, thinking about one's own thoughts. Animals have awareness, but human beings have self-awareness. They not only are aware, but they are aware that they are aware. They're aware of their own awareness. And so when we're talking about the image of God, this is in the book of Genesis, is what highlights human beings, sets them apart, that even as Psalm 8 says, that you made human beings, you made mankind a little lower than God. So that's a remarkable compliment to how God has made human beings, has made them in this position of privilege so that they might rule the earth with God and also walk with God or relate to God, as we see in the early chapters of Genesis. But many people are seeking to attribute rights to animals as well. And this is something that that flies in the face of Scripture. Now, human beings have a stewardship. There is a stewardship that is implied by the image of God, that we, for example, don't cut down a sequoia or redwood forest just because these trees don't have intrinsic rights. But that doesn't mean that we disregard the place of these trees, their beauty, their rarity, the significance of what they contribute to the ecosystem and so forth. So we don't disregard the place of these remarkable trees just because they don't have, say, intrinsic rights. In the same way with animals, there's a certain stewardship that we don't abuse animals or mistreat them in the sense that we perhaps just when buffaloes roamed the plains, people would just wantonly kill them. That is a misuse of our stewardship as those who are God's image bearers. So just because animals don't have intrinsic rights, we don't mistreat them. But on the other hand, we also need to remember that because animals don't have these intrinsic rights, because they're not divine image bearers, you know, we also remember that there is a certain food chain that animals, that we ought to respect for animals, that animals are made to be, many of them are made to be carnivores, to prey upon each other. We don't prevent a lion from killing a gazelle or a zebra. We recognize that this is appropriate, an appropriate part of the world that God has created. So those who would even argue that animals have rights, that animals have this intrinsic value, I'd say, especially I'd argue for those who are maintaining this from a naturalistic point of view, they believe that nature is all the reality that there is no God and so forth. We're led to ask the question, why think that anything would have value if we are the products of blind, deterministic, valueless, material forces? It seems, you know, far easier to argue for value emerging if there is a supremely valuable being who has made human beings than if anything at all could, you know, any value at all could arise from valueless processes. So those are some things that I think figure into this whole discussion. And so those are a few things on the image of God and human exceptionalism.
Well, there are animal activist groups that claim that if you're not willing to eat your own pet, like dogs or cats, that you shouldn't be eating, well, at least in the United States, because there are some cultures that do eat dogs and cats, that you shouldn't be eating cows or pigs. And I'm thinking of this past, earlier this year at the Oscars in February, Joaquin Phoenix won Best Actor for The Joker, and he used his time for his speech to kind of promote veganism because he's a vegan. And so I think a lot of people resonated with that. I mean, he was saying that, you know, we as human beings plunder the earth for its resources, and, you know, we steal babies from cows, and then instead of using the milk for the calf that she had just given birth to, we put it in our coffee and our cereal, and we don't think about how we're treating other beings besides ourselves. You kind of alluded to some of that. And so, you know, how do you answer that? Because that's along the same kind of lines. You know, you're not going to eat your own pet, or do you realize this is how we're treating cows and we're robbing them of their milk so that we can enjoy cereal and coffee?
Well, much of this discussion has to do with the presumption that that animals have rights, that there is a fundamentally elevated status that they have, say, in contrast to, say, what the scriptures might say. But I would say a couple of things. First of all, much of this has to do with our own cultural approach to things. As you said, there are some cultures that will happily eat dogs and cats. They won't, you know, for us, we say, no, I'd prefer to just stick with eating cow and pig products and leave some of those other things off of the menu. Well, a lot of this is a matter of cultural preference. It's not a matter of in principle arguments here. I just if you wanted to eat rats and maybe if you needed to survive, I'd say, yeah, go for it. Grab up those rats and eat them if you need to survive. But all things being equal, I'll stick with other meats that I find more appealing, more tasty for whatever reason, for cultural reasons. But just because I don't eat my pet dog or cat, which is kind of part of our own culture, we don't eat dogs or cats. That doesn't mean that that it'd be in principle wrong to do so. But again, it's sort of like if a person, some people, you know, this brings us to the issue of slaughterhouses. Some people might say, "How can you work in a slaughterhouse?" That's some people may feel squeamish about that. I understand, but other people may work just fine in a slaughterhouse and not have any matters of conscience or squeamishness. Same sort of thing when it comes to even just war. Some people may not have the stomach for fighting in, I do believe that they're just wars, for fighting in such a war. They may want to serve in a medical corps or serve in the kitchen rather than on the front lines. Others may do that in good conscience, and that is fine, but others may be a bit more reserved about that, and that's fine. And so in the same way, when it comes to what animals we eat, I don't think it's a matter of hypocrisy. It's just a matter of respecting things like just one's conscience, or perhaps even a matter of certain cultural preferences.
The very famous musician, of course, he was a Beatle, Paul McCartney, has said, he's been quoted as saying, "If slaughterhouses had glass walls, we'd all be vegetarians." Now, you were just talking about some of us have better stomachs than others for different practices, but I know a lot of us probably in high school read that seminal book called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair, which was written in the early 20th century about various health violations and very unsanitary practices in the American meatpacking industry, which caused people's stomachs to churn. So what does McCartney mean, and how would you reply to that? Because again, as I asked earlier, there's some people that would feel very troubled by the meatpacking industry, especially I would think, you know, I have a lot of interest in food and I know a lot of people are okay with, you know, people who are boutique farmers and stuff like this, where they get concerned is huge giant corporations where the sanitation standards aren't as they should be or what have you.
Right. And we're not arguing for any low standards in sanitation. We're not looking at compromised health because of the conditions of slaughterhouses and so on. Nothing like that at all. So it's not a matter of what Upton Sinclair is talking about that would indeed need to be addressed. We're talking about would slaughterhouses be permissible given the, you know, given, say, top health standards when it comes to, you know, sanitation, et cetera? Well, keep in mind that, you know, America used to be much more rural and agrarian, used to be much, people would raise animals and they would raise them to consume for dinner that evening. They'd kill the pig that morning and get the pig ready for dinner in the evening. And there's nothing strange or odd about that. I think the idea of slaughterhouses with glass walls, we'd all be vegetarians sort of idea is spoken or asked or stated by someone who is writing from a modern suburban point of view where killing animals is not part of the warp and woof of our everyday lives, whereas it had been in the past, and there's nothing strange about that. And so when we're talking about slaughterhouses, we're talking about, yes, on a more intensive scale to provide food for a lot more people who aren't slaughtering their own animals anymore, but are living in apartments and densely populated areas. But this makes food widely available to them, giving them these protein packs that they can benefit from nutritionally. It's something that's tasty, something that a lot of people just simply enjoy. You'll often read testimonials of people who have been hardcore vegans. And then they just say, "I couldn't get away from how much I love eating meat, and they go back to eating meat. And so it's not as though that there's something in principle wrong with this, but I think so, because so often we're removed from the everydayness of slaughtering our own animals and putting them on the dinner table that evening, that this seems to be make us squeamish, or it looks grotesque or whatever. Well, that simply hasn't been a part of our past. And I think that given the fact that these factories, that can seem very negative and so forth, but it's intensive. It's trying to provide a lot more food for a lot more people, that there's nothing in principle wrong with this. Again, assuming that these sanitation conditions are all taken care of.
Well, one thing I definitely want to ask you about is how scripture addresses the issue of meat eating and, plant-based diet. And for our listeners, you can go onto our website. If you go to the landing page of this particular episode, we will link to the Practical Hermeneutics article that addressed the passage in Isaiah and vegetarianism, because we have answered it in that format before. But why don't you just talk to us about those people who would say, well, first of all, Adam and Eve, just how they were in the garden, they weren't eating meat and so forth, and that didn't come till later.
Right. When we look at the creation account, there is the emphasis on a plant-based diet at the end of Genesis chapter 1, that God provides all of these, you know, foods, these fruit-producing plants and herbs and so forth, that are for the benefit of his creation and human beings too. So there is a strong emphasis on a plant-based origination of one's diet, and ultimately even carnivores have a plant-based diet at their root, in that they're often there's often predatory activity on animals that are simple herbivores and don't eat any meat. But what is often overlooked in this, I mean, you can ask questions like, well, what does it mean to rule over the fish of the sea, if not to have them available for eating? Or we need to ask this question too. It looks like everything's vegetarian, everything's vegan in the Garden of Eden. Well, keep in mind too that there are various passages in the Old Testament, like Psalm 104, which is a creation psalm, that indicates that God has created the food chain and that he graciously provides prey for the lion in verse 21. And that God also, it says, he takes away the breath of animals. They die and return to the dust. This is part of the created order. God made animals, and he didn't make them immortal. And God, it says, he provides his creatures with food. And it says, get this, they are satisfied with good. The same word that's used in Genesis chapter 1. But here, the food chain is not seen as something evil, but it's seen as something good. And we see that this is something that is also borne out at the end of the book of Job, where in chapter 39, God is the one who's created the hawk that provides its nestlings food, and they suck up the blood. That God is also, he created Leviathan with fearsome teeth. He, in Job 38, it talks about God, he prepares prey for the lion, that they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in their lair. God even provides the raven its nourishment, and ravens are omnivores but eat mostly meat. So God is the one who put all of these things in place. So even though we look at Genesis 1 and we see a picture of order, we see a picture of harmony, we also need to remember that there are other scriptures that emphasize that there is this bloodiness to creation as well. And so that is something that is often overlooked. In fact, in 1 Timothy 4, we see Paul denouncing these teachings of these false teachers who are saying that you ought to stay away from eating certain foods and so forth. And God says that these things have been created by God. This is part of God's good creation, and we ought to receive them with thankful hearts. So this is the emphasis that we see throughout the scriptures, that there is one, a food chain, and also that God, from the very outset, allows human beings to participate in eating from those good gifts that are seen as part of the creation that he has given to human beings to enjoy.
So there are some Christians that claim that Christians should pursue a diet which models maybe a new creation ideal of not eating meat, like, for instance, in the new heavens and the new earth after the return of Christ, you know, the lion and the lamb will be lying down together and so forth. So is this an ideal kind of way to eat for Christians now? And some vegans I know aren't even a fan of cooking. They would say that the best way to have a diet is not only to have it plant-based, but also raw.
Okay. Well, the raw or cooked, I suppose that's another layer of something to talk about. But I think first we should deal with some of those passages that refer to the lion and the lamb, that there seems to be this harmony, that even mention of animals eating straw, that, you know, carnivores like bears and lions and so forth eating straw. Does that mean that there's going to be all animals in the new heavens and the new earth are going to be eating grass? There's going to be no carnivorosity and so forth. Well, here we have to be careful. For one thing, the language is highly symbolic. It's highly poetic, that when you have mention of lions and bears and so forth eating grass, it's a picture of domestication. It's basically referring to a removal of all danger. You have key passages. You have Isaiah 11, you have Isaiah 35, and you have Isaiah 65, which refer to this new order. But if you're going to push these things literally, you're going to run into a lot of trouble. For one thing, in Isaiah 65, in the new heavens and the new earth, it refers to if a person dies at the age of 100, he'll be considered a mere youth. Well, I thought that there's actually going to be no death in the new heavens and the new earth. Well, it's, of course, referring to longevity. It's referring to how people are going to live a long time. Also, for those who say, you know, that there are going to be lions and lambs in the new heavens and the new earth, well, maybe. But it does say in Isaiah 35, verse 9, it says that there will be no lion there in the new heavens and the new earth. That is, all danger will be removed. So one passage will say there will be a lion and a lamb. Another passage says there's not going to be any lion there at all. Well, the point is that all danger is going to be removed. Not that everybody's going to be eating a vegan-based diet, including animals. Also, it says in Isaiah 25 that when the new heavens and the new earth are about and God removes the shroud of death and so forth, it says there will be feasting on, you know, rich marrow, which is talking about these rich meats that people could eat in feasting and so forth. Does that mean that we will, after all, be eating meat in the new heavens, the new earth? Well, you've got, if you take all of these things literally, you're going to run into some contradictions. So at base, what we're saying is that there is no reason to think that there is going to be a strict vegetarianism or veganism in the new heavens and the new earth, that all animals are going to be vegan and so forth. No, you have to be careful about reading highly symbolic, highly poetic literature in a very literalistic sort of way. Secondly, or thirdly, maybe, we could add too that part of the new heavens and the new earth will mean that there will be no marriage in this new state. Does that mean that we should just go ahead and advance a new creational ethic by not getting married and not having children, therefore? No, that's part of the created order that God has put into place. And so marriage is a good gift from God while we are here on this earth. And so we shouldn't try to make any moves to try to advocate for a new creational model that, you know, for the new heavens, the new earth, by not marrying at all. So again, there's a certain inconsistency that is going on here. And so we need to just read the scriptures in their breadth and make sure that we're not being selective in the sorts of texts that we look at and ignore others.
So does the Bible have anything to say to those who insist that the most compassionate diet, or the diet that Jesus would have approved, is a strictly vegan one?
We need to understand that Jesus, every Passover, ate lamb. This was part of his diet. that also Jesus was one who endorsed the Old Testament, which talks very freely about the not only the sacrificial system, and some of which would go to helping to feed priests and their families. This was something that was seen as a part of the whole creation was seen as, you know, everything belongs to the Lord, but he also gives these gifts freely to human beings to enjoy. That God is one who has bestowed upon humanity the gift of eating meat. And so Paul stands against those who restrict the diet of the believer by saying, as Colossians 2:21 says, you know, those who say, do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. Paul says that this is a false piety. That those who stand against eating meat and or who also forbid marriage and so forth, 1 Timothy chapter 4, these are teaching doctrines of demons. They're teaching something that is not substantially pious at all. It's a shadow. It's a foreshadowing of what is to come, namely the substance of which is Christ. And so those who insist that the most compassionate diet is a strictly vegan one, remember that Jesus, even after his resurrection from the dead, ate fish to show that his body was truly physical, that it wasn't a spirit. Jesus tried to demonstrate this. So here Jesus is throughout his life. He's multiplying fish for the multitudes to eat. He's telling parables about the fatted calf that is to be slain when the prodigal son comes home. All sorts of pictures of eating meat, of feasting and so forth. And you see the consistent drumbeat throughout the scriptures of the goodness, the benefit of the blessing of eating meat. Even in Deuteronomy 14:26, it says, you may spend the money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen, sheep, or wine, or strong drink, whatever your heart desires, and there you shall eat in the presence of the Lord your God and rejoice, you and your household. So there is this picture of God's generous provision, even through the animal world, of allowing human beings to feast and to enjoy the good gifts that God has given to them.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Paul after this very intensive discussion on veganism. So we've been talking about meat. So chicken or beef?
I think both.
Oh, you got to pick one.
Oh, I do like beef more than chicken, but I guess I was looking at the angle, which is better for you or whatever. But yeah, I do like the taste of beef a lot better.
Are you an introvert or extrovert?
Extrovert.
An early bird or night owl?
Early bird.
Are you highly organized or go with the flow?
I'm fairly organized, but I do go with the flow periodically.
And it's early May 2020, so most of us are still in a shelter in place in our cities in the United States. So since we've had a toilet paper shortage at your house, when you put toilet paper on the holder, are you over or under?
It is under.
You're under. Okay. I think you're the first person to ever say that so far that I've asked. Well, Paul, thanks for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Dr. Paul Copan, who has written an online exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. You can read it for free at our website, equip.org, and it's called VeggieTales Gone Rogue, PETA Veganism and the Christian Faith. In addition, you can partner with us and help support this podcast by giving us a donation so that you can receive, as our thank you, the book that Paul co-wrote called What Would Jesus Really Eat? The Biblical Case for Eating Meat, on which his article is based. So if you want to go deeper into the subject, we highly recommend that you get his book. And thank you for your partnership and your support of the Christian Research Institute. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media. Like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Anagraph, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts.
Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.